ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Should the federal government have the power to restrict the movement of former immigration detainees in the community? Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. The High Court has struck down the federal government's ankle bracelet and curfew monitoring scheme for refugees who have completed prison sentences. It's the latest in a series of High Court decisions centering on a cohort of non-citizens that the government wants to keep off our streets and to ultimately deport. University of Queensland Professor Rebecca Ananian-Welsh is an expert in national security and constitutional law. Rebecca, in a nutshell, what's the tension at the heart of this decision and the others like it?
The tension here, though it seems like it's about, you know, migration and risk, is actually really about government constraining liberty. So when the government wants to put someone in detention or curfews or ankle bracelets, who can do it and how, and who can't do it and by what process can't they?
And this is a constitutional question because we have Chapter 3 of our Constitution.
Absolutely a constitutional question. When you've got power and you've got values and principles, we're in constitutional law.
So it's a separation of powers issue because we have Chapter 3 of the Constitution, which tells us what judges can do and can't do. And on the other side of the ledger, you have what the executive and what the government can and can't do.
Absolutely. So since ye olde England and the Magna Carta, we've had this idea that people can be punished for breaking the law and for nothing else, and that punishment needs to be proportionate and it should be by some sort of fair process. That's what courts do. So courts punish people, they can send them to jail, whereas you have the government and there's limits on what they can do. They can't just decide that someone goes to jail.
Okay, so that's at the heart of the tension of this case and others like it. And this latest case involved a plaintiff known only as EGH19. Who is he?
EGH19 is a man who came here as a minor on his parents' visa and then as a minor committed murder.
So he was born in PNG and he came to Australia as a 7-year-old, I think, right?
Yeah. And then he did his time, he was released, and he committed a series of kind of further offences, stalking and threatening kind of offences. So he has been up against the criminal justice system since he was a kid. He's been released, and then as a non-citizen, he could be held in immigration detention. His Australian visa was taken off him once he reached adulthood, and he was held in immigration detention.
So in April 2025, he's released back into the community. His refugee status has been taken off him at that point, so he's a non-citizen. But as we're going to discuss, he can't be deported. So at that point, what, he is required to wear an ankle bracelet and obey a curfew between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m.? Are these the conditions imposed on him?
Yeah, there was a whole host of conditions that could be imposed on him under this special kind of new visa the government had created that included curfews between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. and wearing an ankle bracelet for electronic monitoring all the time. So those were some of the most intrusive things that were placed on these people who were no longer in detention.
Stepping back, EGH19, he's part of a cohort of people who benefited from a very significant 2023 High Court decision called NZYQ. Why was that decision such a legal earthquake? And why is this latest decision part of the ongoing tremors which are taking place as a result of it?
So to understand NZYQ and why it was such a big legal deal, it helps to go back to 2004 in a case called Al-Khateb. And in Al-Khateb, the High Court said, look, these people who are in immigration detention with no reasonably foreseeable prospects of ever getting out, that's fine. Look, it's still for immigration purposes, we're going to let the government do this. In NZYQ, the High Court unanimously, in one judgment, overturned Al-Khateeb. It said no.
And Al-Khateeb, that involved a stateless Palestinian man who'd applied unsuccessfully for refugee status. When all his options were exhausted, he's stateless, so he can't be deported. And the High Court said, well, OK, you're stuck in immigration detention indefinitely, even though there's nowhere to deport you. That's OK. So that's what Al-Khateeb said. But then that was overturned by NZYQ, wasn't it?
Yes. So in NZYQ, the court said, if someone's never going to get deported, then you can't say the reason we're detaining them is to process their deportation. That just doesn't add up. That becomes punishment. All detention is prima facie punishment, and you can only overcome that if you've got a really clear non-punitive purpose, like processing immigration, and what you're doing is actually going to achieve that. And it's what the word court said is reasonably capable of being seen as necessary for that purpose. Detaining someone forever is not.
So NZYQ overturned Al-Khateeb, and that led to about 150 immigration detainees, most of them sort of refugees with criminal records, being released back into the community. They've basically finished their prison sentences and then been dumped immediately into immigration detention, and they were released into the community. And that's a huge significance of NZYQ.
It is. It was just that they couldn't be detained any longer. So the government started scrambling quite quickly to figure out, what can we do? We're not prepared to just give them their full liberty. We want to regulate them somehow, but detention's off the plate. So they came up with curfews and ankle bracelets and these new kind of visas with a bunch of other stuff as well. And that allowed them to control these people, to know where they are, to have home detention in a sense, except along came the case of YBF Zed.
And YBF Zed, that's the 2024 case. He's a bloke born in Eritrea in 1997. He has refugee status. His status was cancelled after an imprisonment for offences including burglary and recklessly causing injury. He's diagnosed with schizophrenia. So he challenges the government's first curfew and ankle bracelet scheme, and he succeeds, and the House of Cards falls down. What does the government do next?
It tries to respond directly to what the court has said in YBF said. So what you have is the government rewriting the legislation as little as it needs to, and using a lot of the words you see in that case. So how the YBFZ kind of visa conditions worked is, in a nutshell, everyone who couldn't be deported, who was in endless immigration detention, that cohort, well, more or less automatically was going to have these onerous visa conditions placed on them, unless the minister decided that that wasn't necessary to protect the Australian community. And the High Court said, this is just a blanket intrusion on liberty in a really serious way. This is home detention. This is electronic monitoring. And you're not doing it according to any kind of, like, it's not proportionate to a non-punitive purpose. You're not trying to protect the Australian community from the outset. You're doing it because you can't do anything else with them. Not good enough. So what the government did was be really clear in the next version of the laws about what the purpose was. So the minister needs to look at the person and be satisfied that placing these conditions on them will protect the community from the harm that would arise from the risk of this person committing a serious offence. So it's quite specific about the minister's satisfaction. Only when the minister's satisfied that a curfew is going to protect the community from this person committing offences or serious offences, then they get curfews, ankle bracelets, whatever.
So these were the government's new or newish regulations for dealing with this cohort. But last week, five of the seven judges of the High Court found this unconstitutional. So what was the reasoning of the majority of the High Court in finding this latest scheme of the government and this latest process unconstitutional?
So we have here the same five judges who said the YBF said laws were unconstitutional, saying that the EGH 19 laws, these new ones, were unconstitutional as well, and the same two dissented. And what they've said across these cases is a couple of things, two things. One, ankle bracelets and curfews are punishment. You are intruding really seriously on someone's liberty here, and that's the kind of punishment that under our constitutional system is done by a court unless you've got a really good exceptional kind of reason not to. And the next thing they say is the scheme that you've created here, it's not reasonably necessary. It's not justified according to the non-punitive purpose you've given us. In YBF said that was protecting the community from harm. In EGH 19 it was stopping the commission of offences, protecting the community, again, from harm arising from offences. These both cases took the whole kind of idea of the separation of powers into new territory and have really limited governmental power to intrude on the rights of citizens.
So this is a very significant decision.
Very, very. And a lot of what was left unclear by YBF said has been clarified in this case.
And what for you is the most important, significant principle which emerges from the majority decision here?
One of the most significant things in this case is that the High Court didn't believe the legislation, that just putting in a really clear non-punitive purpose in writing, saying this is why we're doing it, isn't going to be good enough. They're going to look at not just what the scheme looks like, but the process. It was really important for the court that the minister was, they're satisfied this is protecting the community, but they reached that decision not hearing from the other person, with no limits on what information they should or shouldn't take into account. You know, there's no rules of evidence. They don't have to take into account expert reports. The minister can reach that state of satisfaction on the balance of probabilities based on who knows what.
A briefing from an office in the department, perhaps.
I guess so. There's nothing in the legislation around any of that, and there's none of the ideas of procedural fairness or even the giving of reasons. So that really troubled the court. They said these things are important here. So they looked deeply at how the legislation works. The other thing was that the court really centred liberty, and they were aware, the majority justices were really aware of their role here, not in managing or telling the government how to manage risky migrants, but in controlling executive power. So a few of them referred to the fact that if they upheld this law, then a similar law would therefore be allowed over Australian citizens, that the minister could just become satisfied somehow without natural justice, that any Australian citizen posed a risk of committing a serious offence and decide in an administrative decision to impose a curfew, ankle bracelets, who knows what else. That's not determinative, but they looked at that and went, if you look at it through that lens, this is a really serious, pretty arbitrary power we're dealing with here. Not good enough. It looks like punishment. It needs to go to a court.
Very interesting. So you're saying that if the majority had upheld this law, it could have opened the door to a similar system, a minister making a determination that any Australian citizen could have been subject to, I don't know, ankle bracelets or curfews or even detention.
Absolutely.
So that was the thinking of the majority. But two judges disagreed with the majority. What did they say?
Justices Stewart and Beach Jones dissented here. Again, it was a repeat of what they'd kind of said in YBF said. And for Beach Jones, he didn't see curfews and ankle bracelets as that bad. He said, look, we've seen photos of these ankle bracelets. They're pretty discreet. You can wear them under pants. this is the kind of thing, I don't even think that this is punishment. This is just regulation. This isn't too bad. Once you look at it that way, he said, look at all this protections you have. Sure, there's no natural justice, but the minister has to be satisfied and there's all these criteria and it's about serious offending. And when you weigh these two things against each other, he says, I think it's capable of being seen as necessary for a legitimate non-punitive purpose, community protection. So he does a really straight kind of analysis, weighting the factors quite differently.
What about Justice Stewart?
Justice Stewart seems quite angry at the rest of the court. And it's funny because the rule of law plays quite a big role in some of these judgments. For the majority, the rule of law and the separation of powers is about protecting liberty and making sure that the intrusions on liberty by the state are subject to fairness and justice and proportionality, etc. For Justice Stewart, he refers to the rule of law as saying the courts need to respect the decisions of the representative parliament. And right here, we've got parliament and the executive managing visa conditions. They've always done that. And they've decided they want to stop these serious offences. And that's absolutely what they should be able to do. None of this is telling me exclusively judicial power. Visa conditions, community protection, classic executive power. Looking at it from his perspective, this was not, like, it was not necessarily punishment. Well, it wasn't punishment in a particular sense. And he goes down a different path to the rest of the court on what punishment is. He says, the punishment I'm looking for here is the kind of action which is exclusively judicial. It's in the courts, sending someone to jail for committing a criminal offence. Visa conditions, ankle bracelets, curfews, this isn't exclusively judicial. This is the kind of thing that ministers can do with visa conditions forever. I'm not satisfied this is a separation of powers issue. It's all reasonably capable of being seen as necessary community protection, purely protective, nothing to see here.
And what do we know about this cohort? Have some of them who were released back into the community a few years ago, have they re-offended? Have they committed serious crimes?
We have had, it's a big cohort and it's a diverse cohort. There was a lot of attention paid to them after NZYQ.
It was a huge political issue,
massive.
Issue.
Yep. And you had some of them being picked up on drug charges. I believe one was involved in an assault. We're talking hundreds of people and things like that happened, absolutely.
You're listening to The Law Report on ABC Radio National and we're talking about the High Court, which has just struck down the federal government's ankle bracelet and curfew monitoring scheme for refugees who've completed their prison sentences. It's been part of an ongoing series of cases following a big decision back in 2023. My guest is University of Queensland Professor Rebecca Ananian-Welsh. So, coming back to the big picture here, so there's this tension between what a government can do and what the courts can do. Rebecca, we do have a lot of preventative detention in Australia. We have a lot of schemes where courts can keep somebody in jail or prevent somebody from being released even after they've served their time in jail. What schemes do we have around the country and what have been some of the big cases there?
A really interesting thing that comes out of this case, actually, is that the court observes that it's become really normalised. So you're right. Before, say, the year 2000, it was almost unthinkable that you would detain someone because of what they might do in the future rather than what they had done in the past. It had crept in for sex offenders in the 90s, and then post-September 11, rise of kind of terrorism law, we saw this. We need to stop bad things from happening. So from 2007 onwards, we've seen control orders for terrorists, post-sentence detention for terrorists, more and more schemes of post-sentence detention for not just sex offenders, but a whole raft of serious offenders. And also control orders, people might recall, for bikies. So kind of risky people, even if they haven't committed an offence, having their liberty somehow curtailed. absolutely wall-to-wall across Australia.
And those control orders might be, for instance, curfews or being ordered not to associate with certain types of people, those sorts of things, or reporting to police and what have you.
How some of these are phrased, and the very first control orders in Australia were to protect the community from terrorists, often people acquitted of terrorism offences, and they could allow for absolutely anything. Anything that a court, because they're court-ordered, decided was reasonably necessary, reasonably appropriate and adapted to protect the community from, be it terrorism or serious crime. Not detention, though. So control orders are anything, anything. Education, curfews, checking in, don't go there, can't use a mobile phone, can't use the internet, whatever it's going to take to protect the community.
But we do also have preventative schemes which keep people behind bars. We have a system in Victoria, for instance, which was upheld in the case of Ben Bricker. He's a radical Islamist preacher jailed for leading a terror organisation and conspiracy to carry out terrorist acts. He served his time, but he's still behind bars because a judge has decided that he poses an unacceptable ongoing risk to the community, right?
At first, the post-sentence detention of offenders was approached really carefully. And certainly in the 90s, that kind of scheme was struck down in the case of Cable, who was a repeat sex offender. And then it was upheld in 2004 in the case of Farden, another repeat sex offender. For Ben Breaker, it was the first time the Commonwealth had tried this. And that was upheld in that case by the High Court. Critical thing was that that was issued by a court. So you have a full court hearing about whether an expert report and other kinds of evidence establishes a unacceptable risk, is usually the term, that this person is going to commit a serious offence in the future.
So bearing in mind that the Constitution allows for this kind of ongoing consequence, why didn't the federal government create a system, a judicial system, post-NZYQ, when that cohort of 150 people were released from immigration detention? Why didn't they create a judge-led decision-making process for determining if someone in that cohort should be subject to conditions like wearing an ankle bracelet or abiding by a curfew? Why didn't they do that?
What's really amazing, and this did not help the Commonwealth in EGH 19, is that they did. They created two systems side by side to achieve the same end. This was in this political scramble, quick, what are we going to do about these people we have to let out? And so they created this ministerial process, streamlined ministerial satisfaction, you present a risk of blah, blah, blah.
The one that's just been struck down?
Yes. And side by side to that, they created a judicial version where the government needs to go to a court and in a hearing on the basis of evidence, etc., a judge can determine that the person presents an unacceptable risk, etc., and order, be it curfews, ankle bracelets, whatever. Now, that system, you can imagine if you're the government, you've got a streamlined one and you've got one that you've got to pay lawyers, you've got to go to court, it's going to take a while. That system hasn't really been used. Sorry, it hasn't been challenged, but it just hasn't been used. And quite a few members of the High Court said, look, we're pointing out these problems with this ministerial version. And what makes those so much more obvious is that you've created a judicial version to achieve the same ends. So it can be done, and it can be done with procedural fairness and rules of evidence, and you can get the same outcome. You can have someone subjected to all these things. You just need to prove it to a judge.
Prove it to a judge that this person presents a risk to the community or whatever, and therefore you can have them wear an ankle bracelet and be subject to a curfew. So the system is there. The government just never activated it.
Yeah, they've decided they didn't want to go for the longer path. But that's a lot of what the separation of powers is about, that if you, and this is the majority really gets to this, the values that our system is built on, like liberty and fairness, they manage that relationship between people and the state. And they say, well, state, you can intrude on people's lives. You can put them in detention, ankle bracelets, curfews, whatever. But we have courts to manage that process. And at the end of that process, they may well go to jail or have been in curfews, but there is a process. And so the majority of the court here said, go do that. You can't shortcut that by just giving the power to the minister.
Okay, so we have this decision last week in the High Court of Australia, 5-2, in favour of the plaintiff, Mr. EGH19. So now this cohort of people will no longer have to wear ankle bracelets. They will no longer have to wear, subject to a curfew. What's going to happen now? What's the government's long-term plan?
So where all this controversy problems came from was NZYQ saying this group of people can't be deported and you don't want them in, so we have an issue here. What the government's done is do a deal with Nauru, that little island nation that has 13,000 people, to pay them billions of dollars to take this group. Now, what that means for these individuals, you know, constitutionally, I guess, is they are deportable now, which means they can go straight back into detention.
The Australian newspaper and the Canberra Times is reporting that I think 6 people have already been deported to Nauru. 27 have been detained after their visas were approved by the Nauruan government, and another 27 are awaiting a decision on their visa applications. So it looks like the government will try and push as many people as it can into Nauru. What issues does this scheme raise for you?
One thing that strikes me, look, as a lawyer and as someone who's passionate about the rule of law and things, is the double standard that we have a lot of Australians who commit horrible crimes and we let them be dealt with by the court system and they do their time and then they're back on the streets, or we have these other post-sentence things to deal with them. Some of these people in this NZYQ kind of group have been in Australia for a very long time, and it seems imbalanced to me to have this, they've done their time, but we can't let them out attitude. There are other options in Australia to deal with them. And the other part of me, which is the national security lawyer, wonders about the actual effects of this. So if they're here, we can kind of deal with them. If they're in Nauru, we can't. It's a kind of off you go, be free. It's not a particularly good international citizenship thing. And with the world being globalised, what does that mean for potential future Australian security even? We lose control of them.
What about the safety of the people of Nauru? If these people are, as the government tells us, or some of them are, or many of them are, most of them are, dangerous criminals.
There's some real funny logic, I think, in all this. The big justification behind this is this messaging around how dangerous these people are. But instead of putting constraints on them here, which is absolutely an available option, we're sending them off to be free in Nauru. Nauru has 13,000 people, so think a small town in Australia. And we seem to have the intention of putting hundreds of apparently very risky people into that community where there's already problems for housing and food shortages and high unemployment, medical facilities dealing with this. It seems like Australia isn't particularly concerned about that, and that seems odd to me. It feels like short-term thinking to say, don't worry, we've done something, but the longer-term problems may be quite significant.
Professor Rebecca Ananian-Welsh, an expert in national security and constitutional law at the University of Queensland, thank you. Thank you for speaking to the Law Report about these issues.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
That's all we've got time for this week. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and to audio producer this week, Ross Richardson. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.